Welcome in, everybody. This is my name is Nick, and this is Brian. This is the Foundation After Show. We're doing part of my channel. We've essentially been watching like the first three episodes of this show and kind of wanted a place to talk about it afterwards. It seems like it's going to be one of those shows that sticks around for a while, at least you know, maybe I'm not giving too much away as far as my thoughts on it so far, but it does feel like something that has some staying power, and we kind of want to talk about it. It's a very dense one, so we think an after show is kind of warranted for this kind of thing as well.
Oh, for sure.
But again, my name is Nick. I do I essentially write film reviews, and I do a watch party every week on my channel. That should be like linked or it should be on the overlay here. We essentially do watch parties every Friday at 8 p.m.
Monday.
Every Monday. Sorry, yeah, you're right. Every Monday is at 8 p.m. Eastern time. And I'll let you go ahead and introduce yourself.
Hey, I'm Brian. I am a editor and contributor to Geeks Worldwide. I join Nick every so often on his watch parties. I try to contribute as much as I can. As of right now, I'm just working my normal stuff and doing things like this with Nick. Like how we said, Foundations is such a dense show that there's so many different themes that are displayed on each week's episode that definitely talking about it will be a great way to understanding more of like what they're trying to say, their themes, and this is really cool, and I'm really happy that he invited me on again, so this is gonna be fun.
Awesome. Yeah, so before we start kind of diving into the episode and episodes like 1 through 3, we did watch 1 and 2 probably about a week or two ago, and kind of that's kind of where we kind of I don't know, I don't want to speak for you, but that's kind of where I realized that it was going to be a bigger show, and that it's something I really liked because I hadn't heard about it before. So what we're going to do in this episode, because we just watched episode 3 today, I think both of us, so it's a little more fresh for us, is we're going to do a quick kind of review and recap of our overall thoughts of the series, and then we're going to vaguely touch on episode 1 and 2. And before we dive into that, though, I do want to say, just starting off here, that neither of us have read Isaac Asimov's series, his amazing Foundation series. I've heard amazing things about it, but neither of us have read the book. So we're coming at this solely from the perspective of people that have just kind of stumbled upon the TV show, and we're wanting to kind of dive into what the TV show has given us, and we're not able to make any kind of comparisons to what happened with the book series and stuff like that. So if you guys are looking for like a deep dive on people that potentially have read the books and are kind of going through comparisons, this isn't going to be that show. But we did see that there is a Foundation podcast, so they may be a little more in-depth on that. So if you guys are looking for something to chew on in that regard, that might be the way to go for you, but it's not going to be in this podcast. So
yeah,
if you guys did read the books and are very interested in the show and have thoughts about the show, feel free to hang out and talk with us and stuff like that. But again, we're just going to be coming from that point of view. So hopefully there's no spoilers or anything in chat or anything that comes up. But yeah, that's going to be kind of our frame of reference here. But I wanted to get into just our basic overall thoughts so far and kind of give people that here. What were your thoughts on just the show as a whole so far and what you think of it, kind of broad strokes?
Well, when I saw that Jared Harris was involved, my immediate thought was this is going to be a very deep, dense show. And it's going to be it's going to touch upon a lot of themes that most sci-fi shows very rarely try to approach and discuss. Jared Harris, if you guys don't know, he is one of the lead actors from the amazing HBO miniseries Chernobyl. Highly recommend watching that if you haven't done so yet. But yeah, no, my initial thoughts of the show so far was it's really unique. It's really interesting because it's a sci-fi show that deals heavily with a lot of themes that I saw in like Battlestar Galactica, Babylon 5, and things like that. And those are shows that uses politics, real world analysis, the way that the world is set up, and they interpret it into the future. And when I saw the first episode and they were slowly doing that, it really caught my interest. Granted, there's no Cylons trying to blow up planets and things.
Right.
Well, I mean, in other episodes,
yeah. Yeah.
But it touched upon a lot of stuff that we sci-fi tends to steer away from. So a show to incorporate modern themes in the future really got to me. And when they did that in the first episode, I'm like, okay, this is going to be a really great show. They're going to do justice. And the actors, like I said, Jared Harris is in it, Lee Pace.
Yeah, the acting's fantastic. Some of the actors they have in are fantastic. Yeah, so the initial thing that jumps out to me is the scope. The scale of this show is just insane. it's one of the biggest scope shows that I've ever seen. And as far as like the production value, the quality, the just the scale of everything seems so huge. The effects work and stuff feel like movie quality. Like all of them feel like, and we may dive into that episode by episode as far as like the technical effects work and stuff like that. But that stood out to me as really big. It does have, like, you came to it through Jared Harris. I think I came to it through Lee Pace because I saw Lee Pace was involved in it. I was a huge fan of his after The Fall is one of my favorite movies. Yeah. He did Halt and Catch Fire, which I thought was fantastic.
That was so good.
I was kind of following his career and I saw that he was doing this show. And then I realized it was a big book series from Asimov. And I was like, well, Lee Pace, Asimov, that seems like a good for me. Yeah.
Well, with Asimov, have you had any, because I know he also wrote iRobot, which the movie was completely different from the books. I read a little bit of the books, iRobot, because it dealt with like the three laws of robotics. So like I was very familiar with his stuff from iRobot and stuff like that. Were you familiar with his other writings or his other like properties like that?
No, not firsthand. I've been familiar with kind of like his stamp in the industry because so many things, like when I read about so many things and so many sci-fi properties in Hollywood or whatever, a lot of them are either based on properties that were inspired by Asimov's writing or they're directly based on Asimov's writing. So a lot of those kind of like you said, the three laws of robotics, those kind of bigger kind of philosophical ideas that take place in the sci-fi realm are a lot of it is rooted in his original work. So that's kind of how I came to it. But I don't think I've read anything like specifically from Isaac Asimov.
Okay, yeah, I never finished iRobot, like, because it was a bunch of anthologies that explained the three laws of robotics in different scenarios. Like, after the first two, it was just, I got to the point where I'm like, okay, I get it. It's, I get the three laws. You don't have to, like, rephrase the same scenario in different ways to explain it. So, yeah, I'm like, I got it.
Yeah. So, yeah. It's, I mean, that's kind of how I came to it through was Lee Pace. But again, those things, the main things I noticed were just the production quality and the scale were probably the two things that jumped out at me the most about the show. And then, you know, another thing too is a lot of people have been talking in the last couple years, maybe 2 years, I guess, since it ended. But everyone's been talking about the industry buzzword of the next Game of Thrones. I think there was like a... It's not saying that this is like Game of Thrones, but it's saying that like, what's the next big everyone talk around the water cooler kind of show that's going to kind of take the public zeitgeist by hold and just kind of like capture the attention of the mass audiences and stuff. That's kind of what I got from what that term was.
Yeah. And it's also The Walking Dead, where like when The Walking Dead was at its peak, it was, hey, did you see Walking Dead last night? I was like, no, I haven't seen it yet. I'm going to watch it after work. Don't say anything. We'll talk about it tomorrow. Right. And it was the same thing with like Game of Thrones. So there is a void where there's not really a show that will, that has that, like, did you see last week's episode? Did you see yesterday's episode? And Foundation has the potential to kind of fill that void a little bit, but we have to see if it does or doesn't. Yes.
Yeah. I think potential is a really good word there because it definitely, I think without giving too much away of our deep dives, I think it's set up that it has the potential to do that as far as how the comparison I want to make to Game of Thrones is just the scale of it, because Game of Thrones was a giant show at the time, even with its first season, as far as the budget and the kind of world that it's building out. This is also a huge budget show with a giant world that it's building out and a lot of interesting characters. So it's similar in that regard. It's also similar in that it kind of shows the perspective of the layman or the kind of blue collar characters, as well as like the political intrigue of like royalty and all that kind of stuff and the inner workings of that. So it has that in common as well. And it's also a dense show. Whereas when you're watching Game of Thrones season one, you're trying to catch like names and houses and all the backgrounds and stuff, and they're not holding your hand as much about it. And I think that's very similar in this show too, where the first couple episodes, they're throwing a lot at you and they're not walking you through it slowly. It's just kind of like they're hoping you catch up, you know?
Yeah, they're not dumbing it down for you. They're saying, hey, this is our show. You're either going to jump on or not get involved at all. And I think that's a lot to do with like the creators of it, because it's David Goyer and Josh Friedman. And David S. Goyer, he is known for this type of stuff. He's done a lot of these unique things. His repertoire, like his work of art, is huge. And if I remember correctly, I think he did The Watchmen. Did he do The Watchmen?
No, that was Damon Lindelof did The Watchmen. David Goyer is mostly known, from what I know him from, is doing the Dark Knight trilogy, and I think he was working with Jonathan Nolan on writing the Dark Knight trilogy.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. He did. Also did Ghost Rider.
He's also done a lot of Zack Snyder's DC, helped with a lot of Zack Snyder's DC movies and stuff like that as well. But
he did the Puppet Masters.
Oh, okay.
Oh, snap. He did Dark City. Dark City was a great, great film. Highly underrated.
Is that like the older one with Rufus Sewell and I think Kiefer Sutherland was in that as well. It's the one that everyone says The Matrix took from.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. It's Rufus Sewell, Kiefer Sutherland, and Jennifer Connelly.
Yeah. So yeah, he's definitely got a background. He's very good at like wide scale, big scope shows. He's got a very very big vision. The other thing too I saw was he was involved in Man of Steel too. And I don't know if you noticed this too, but a lot of the tech they use seems reminiscent of like Krypton tech.
Yeah. He wrote for the film Krypton.
Right. Right.
And he did Constantine. He definitely has a lot to do with like sci-fi comics. Mm-hmm. Things like that. So this is definitely within his wheelhouse.
So, having seen the first three episodes, where would you rate your interest so far? Like, as far as like 1 to 10, do you feel like you're really invested in the show at this point?
I think I'm going to be like around a 7, just because it's unique enough that the characters are very well acted, very well done. Like, I love Lee Pace as the Emperor Cleon. He's doing an amazing job. Jared Harris, like I said, from Chernobyl, if I see him attached to any project, I'm instantly going to be gravitated towards it because of how well he approaches it. And the fact that it's sci-fi and it's a dense, deep, heavy sci-fi that they're adapting, and they're not picking, like, not belittling like anything else. Like Philip K. Dick, how his work has been redone so many times, and they've done Total Recall, Blade Runners, a lot of his stuff has been adapted already. So doing Asimov, you have to have a set of courage and cojones to do this type of thing. So simple fact that they're challenging themselves to bring this to the small screen, it's unique and it's different from everything else on television.
Yeah.
And just having a straight up sci-fi show like this is, I love sci-fi. Like, that's one of the most underrated forms of television, and I'm digging it. 7 is a good thing. The first three episodes have really got me into it. Like, today, first thing I did when I got to work was like, okay, cool, I have like 50 minutes now, let me just knock out half of the episode, and then I'll knock out the other half when I get another chance.
Yeah, it's definitely like, when you were talking about like sci-fi and how broad this is, one of the few things I had heard about this series before this show even came out was how unadaptable it was. So when people would talk about adapting, Asimov's Foundation series, it was viewed like a holy grail of this unadaptable thing that seems so esoteric and so fit for novelization that it wasn't going to translate to TV well. And, you know, having seen three episodes, I can kind of see where that was as far as like the time jumps and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. It's very hard to visually portray on screen and stuff. So I think, courage is a really good word for it. I think people are probably going to be a lot critical of any changes to such a beloved like novelization and series and stuff like that. So you're not going to please everybody, but I think given the challenge it was to how big of a challenge it is to try to adapt this, I am enjoying it tremendously so far. I'm very invested. I would probably give it an 8 or 9 out of 10 as far as like my investment. I'm very like, I'm very, I have a very strong will to see the end of the season through at least. So, I'm looking forward to the episodes too, especially the last one I think was probably my favorite, the one that we saw, episode 3. We'll definitely get into that and dive into it a little more, but I do want to start with episode 1, and the first thing I want to start with too that I don't think a lot of people talk about is the title sequence. What did you think about the title sequence?
I thought it was good. I liked it a lot. I wish we could be like, oh, here it is, and just like have it play in the background.
Yeah, that would be
cool. But no, like the title sequence was really unique. It was different. So I liked it. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, and I like it as well. I'm a little lukewarm on the theme, the music. It doesn't seem catchy to me. Like, I don't know. It's probably something that as the show goes on will probably grow on me as it goes on. But I think Bear McCreary does the score, and I really like some of his work. I think he did the score for like 10 Cloverfield Lane, and he's done some video game work and all that kind of stuff. He was a composer on Battlestar Galactica. I didn't realize that either. So that makes sense that, you know, they bring him back for that kind of thing as well. So
nice.
He did some Walking Dead work. So he's done a lot of stuff, that I like. So I was kind of psyched when I saw that he was a composer on this. But the title theme, there wasn't a lot to grab onto as far as the melody's concerned. And usually, like, you know how like title scenes usually, they want to get you in the frame of mind for the show. So that might be intentional, because this is such kind of a vague, big scale show that there's not like, I don't know. Kind of gets you in a vast headspace, if that makes sense. So I guess that might be the intention behind it, at least.
Yeah, but, no. Yeah. Like, cause like, almost every great show that we talk about, like they have like a unique, title sequence, unique, theme song, like The Walking Dead, very unique. Battlestar Galactica, very unique. Game of Thrones, very unique. Right. Westworld, another one.
Exactly.
So yeah. So like having the title sequence that correlates with the show and correlates with what's happening in the animation or the visuals usually determines if the show is going to be good or not. Unfortunately, you never hear of a great show having a bad title sequence. And
yeah. And again, it might be something that just grows on you. Like the reason for that might not be that it's objectively like episode one, it was objectively a good title sequence for everybody. But as the things happen with the show, you start to kind of feel some kind of ownership of it as you're going through the journey. So it might be something that just grows on me. I don't dislike it. I just remember thinking like, I wish there was more of a hook or more of a catch to the theme to where like you kind of hum it, you know, every now and then or something. Like, I don't know. It just seems like that would be important. I don't know. I'm nitpicking. It's not a huge deal, but it's just kind of,
well, to be fair, you have the Game of Thrones like dun 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 dun, 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 and you're like, okay, I get that. And The Walking Dead is like,
or even Breaking Bad had like a really cool, like, you know, hook.
I was gonna bring, I get you. I get what you mean.
Yeah,
where it has the chorus, it just gets you. Like, it's like, okay, I'm in it. You guys got me.
So. After the title sequence, we open up on episode one. I believe episode one, I'm going to see if I can get the title for it.
Emperor's Peace.
The Emperor's Peace. Episode one was directed by Rupert Sanders. It was written by David S. Goyer and Josh Friedman. That came out on September 24th here. So that episode opens. It's kind of just a broad strokes about the episode is it's the story of Gail Dornick, I believe. She is leaving her homeworld of Synax. And because she has won some kind of Willy Wonka-esque like algorithm thing, you know?
Yeah, she answered like it's kind of like Good Will Hunting, where like, who answered this impossible math question? And it's like, oh, it was the janitor out over there. So off the bat, I was like, yo, this has Good Will Hunting vibe.
Yeah, it does, yeah.
The janitor was the one that answered the unanswerable math question.
Right. So she's from kind of a nondescript, kind of draconian backwards world that doesn't, you know, they believe in some pretty regressive things, at least
and they don't, is like forbidden, and
right, they don't value math and science, so for her to come from that world is a really big contrast. So she wins that, she leaves her family to go work with this enigmatic kind of big iconic figure in Harry Seldon. He's a professor at I guess a very prestigious school on the main planet of Trantor, I believe is what it's called.
Trantor.
So she goes to work with him. She values his work and stuff. And she and him are the only two people that can understand what we're about to get into too, which is this psycho history, or this kind of like, it reminded me a lot. I don't know if you had watched, there's an FX show called Devs. It was done by Alex Garland, who did Annihilation and Ex Machina and those things. It
sounds familiar, but
yeah, it's called Devs, and the whole show is based on determinism, which is just like we exist on these tram lines where no matter what we do, it's already been predetermined. And
it's like Minority Report.
Yeah, choice is an illusion. Everything, exactly like Minority Report, everything's predetermined. So it really dives into that concept. But psychohistory is apparently if we can follow the patterns of the past, we can predict the future, which is kind of just a basic theme of science. And you know, we can dive into more more of that overall theme as we go into it. But I thought that that was so when they do the psychohistory thing, I thought that was really interesting. And Jared Harris does come off like an enigmatic kind of eccentric, you know, professor. So I thought that was really cool casting. But yeah, it's just the story of her moving from her homeworld to Trantor and kind of learning about this stuff. But the pace starts very quickly. Like once she gets to Trantor, they obviously do the conceit of you're going to be arrested tomorrow, and like it starts the whole chain of events that are going to lead that really quickly.
Yeah, no, it was really, yeah, when they first brought her, like, yeah, by the way, you're getting arrested the moment you land on Trantor, is like, the hell?
Yeah.
And one of the things I liked about the first episode was when she's leaving, her family was like, hey, you're a heretic because you believe in science, mm-hmm. you believe in math and all this stuff. And it touched upon a lot of the views of society today. Like, I know it's going to be like kind of like a deep dive, and we need to kind of make it like a more condensed summary of the first two episodes.
Right.
But it really did touch upon like the stuff that Battlestar Galactica touched upon of mm-hmm. society, how society is viewed. And when she said it, that I was going to be killed on my home planet anyway, you saved me, but you also damned me again. That
right.
No matter what, I was screwed. So I have to go along with you. And you knew this. Mm-hmm. And she figures that out with the psychohistory, where she's like, you already knew that all this was going to happen. And yeah, so
to a degree. So he always says, like, I don't know the specifics, but I can kind of wrap my head around the broad strokes of what I think is going to happen based on pattern. So it's not as in depth as Devs was on FX, which broke down to like, I know what word you're going to say before you say it, but it just does more societal kind of kind of stuff like that. So
like with Loki, are you caught up with Loki or not yet?
I think I finished Loki.
Okay, because I didn't want to like ruin the ending for you or like part of the ending. Because
we can spoiler alert anybody that might be listening to. If you guys haven't seen Loki, maybe skip forward about 30 seconds or something.
But it's very similar to that, where Kang the Conqueror was like, hey, I know what you're going to say before you say it, because I've seen it before. Exactly. So it's really, it's kind of like unique. Like it's almost time travel, but it's not time travel. Like you can't predict something that hasn't happened yet, but you could be as close to it as possible. And it's kind of a unique perspective. Like you can use math and science to kind of predict certain things that will happen, but you can't be a precise number, precise.
And for clarification, it's not like the Kang the Conqueror thing, because he kind of knew immediately. This is more like Harry uses the mathematics and psychohistory, and he has a probability matrix where he says, okay, there's a high probability that this specific thing might happen, but we don't know for sure. It could be a 60% probability, at which case it's almost a 50-50 shot at that point. So it's that kind of thing where he's just using mathematical probability matrix and stuff, you know.
Yes, which is foreshadowed in episode 3, which we'll get to later. So we'll have to definitely circle back to this. Okay. With episode 1, we got introduced to a lot of the main characters in there. So we got introduced to Race. We got Henry. Race, Henry, Gale, Dawn, Dusk, and Day.
Right.
I texted you right away. Like, as soon as I saw Dusk, I'm like, if Christopher Lee was still around, he will be playing him, like legit be playing him. And I'm curious, who would you have liked to see play Dusk?
Ooh, who would I have liked to see him play Dusk? I really like the actor that they got, because I don't know if you notice it too, but he does feel like an older Lee Pace, right? He does. Kind of look like an older version of Lee Pace, which I think is really good casting there. I also have seen that actor, I think his name's Terrence Mann. I've seen him in a show called Sense8 on Netflix, and I really liked him. He was an antagonist in that show, and I thought he was good in that. So I do like that actor that they got. If I had like dream casting, it's weird because I think you have to cast off Lee Pace, right? So you have to cast someone that would be believably be an older version of him. I don't know. That's a really tough one.
That's why I think like when I saw that, I was like, that would have been the perfect role, because I think Christopher Lee would look like an older Lee Pace, but granted, Christopher Lee, if he were to do this, or if he was still around at the time, he would be well into the hundreds.
Right.
But I like Terrence Mann. He was a really good choice to play Brother Dusk.
Yeah. And obviously I love Lee Pace's performance. I think he was brilliantly cast in this, as far as I think what the casting directors realized with him was that he's got such a commanding presence, and this
Yes.
character is obviously you know, we can talk about the narcissism and stuff like that obviously comes through with him, but he is a very very big commanding person. He gives a lot of these speeches. He oversees, you know, he's a king of kings. He oversees like a galactic empire. So you have to get somebody with that kind of gravitas to be able to pull that role off. And I think Lee Pace was a brilliant choice for them there. Yeah, the casting I think all around was great. I think Jared Harris was great for that character. I totally buy that 100%. What did you think of Gail Dornick? Lou LaBelle, I think, plays Gail Dornick. I had heard too, and this is just from reading online and stuff like that, but I had heard that this was a male role in the book and that it was female in the show. I didn't really note it. It didn't feel off to me. So, yeah, I thought she did a good job in the role. But what did you think of Lou LaBelle?
I thought she was great. She nailed the character perfectly. I did not know that it was supposed to be, it was intended to be a male role from the, based off upon the book, that it was a male character. I just assumed that that's just how it was, because she owned it so perfectly. She did everything. They made it her own. She, like, with episode one, you got to see the timid side of her, where she was very timid. She was very meek because it was a new experience, so you got to see that, and it was a great. And then with episode two, like, not jumping ahead, like, oh, we're going now, we're on episode two, but in episode two, she's more comfortable with her surroundings. She's more comfortable with who she is, being on the ship for so long, that she was able to change her style from being meek and mild to being confident of, like, yeah, I know who I am. So she did a great job so far.
Yeah, I thought she was great. I liked Raish. I just think he photographs well. The character that plays Raish, I just think he has like an interesting character to him, as far as like the way he carries himself, and the way he talks, and his appearance. He's just an interesting. I think like I said, I think he photographs well. But I didn't see anybody in there that I didn't like as far as cast members were concerned. I thought everyone was great. I even liked the man, what I forget what religion they are, but the priest that was there, I thought he was really great. I thought his character was really interesting as well. Yeah, I forget what the religion's called, but yeah.
It's something moon or some, it's something weird, but yeah, I know exactly what you mean. Even the casting in this, and they're the two biggest actors, like the two biggest names that we know, that is Lee Pace, and that's really not saying much, and Jared Harris. Those two are really great, excuse me, are really great actors, but they're not, you tell them, oh yeah, Lee Pace is in it, people are like, who the hell's Lee Pace? Jared Harris is in it. Who's Jared? Who's that dude? Oh, from Chernobyl. Oh, okay, yeah, I remember Chernobyl. So they didn't really go for like the marquee name, because since this was also distributed by Apple TV, their shows, like you had the morning shows, like, oh, Jennifer Aniston and Steve Carell. C, oh, Jason Momoa. This was like Foundation. By as
Exactly.
so I
But
really do.
you get big bang for your buck getting Jared Harris and Lee Pace. Like a really big bang for your buck. And the other thing too is, I will say, like, those other shows that you mentioned, like Morning Show and stuff like that, this show is so expensive and so big, and it looks so big and expensive that they had to make concessions somewhere. And I think it was with like paying casting. I think if you would have casted really big names in this, it would have cut into that budget for all of these things, you know, that we see in the show. So I'm really glad they took that route and said, let's get some people that deserve a come up, and let's get some people that can really chew these roles and make them their own. And then let's put a lot of this budget into making the show look as beautiful as possible. And the show looks gorgeous. Like everything about the show looks gorgeous, from the
Oh,
visuals to the
yeah.
production design and everything like that.
So I guess let's get to the meat and potatoes. Let's get to the heavy parts of episode one. Or was it episode two? Either way,
Episode.
episode one.
Well, yeah, the yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead for episode one.
No, they blew up the, there's, it starts the war. It
Was
helps explain.
that one?
I
or was
can't
that
remember what it
two?
was.
It was either one or two, but yeah, that yeah, I did have a criticism about that. I'm not sure if that was in episode one or two that happened though. I think it was episode one. I think you're right. Maybe the end of episode one that they blew it up, because the episode two seemed to be about the fallout from that.
Episode two was a fallout, because we, it showed more stuff. But yeah, no, it was just, it blows up and you're going like, Whoa.
Yeah.
That wasn't supposed to blow up. Yeah, it was episode one. So the
Episode one.
Starbridge blows
Okay.
up. Yeah,
Yeah.
so the Starbridge blows up, and you're going like, oh crap. Because you have the delegates from the two worlds that they represent there trying to offer like work on trade agreements, and it just opens up more of a political arena, political theater, because now you go, you have your ambassadors of these two worlds. They gave you gifts. They're asking for favors. And two members blow up your beacon of your
To
society.
to alleged
Yeah.
members, alleged
Yeah. Because
members,
then they
yeah.
go, yeah, because then they go in episode two, because they start doing the investigation. And it's perfect dialogue, it's perfect like songs, and it's the mythos, it's the culture that they brought into it, where it's very politically based, it's very historically based, it's very not guerrilla warfare, but fighting against your aggressors.
Right.
And those are themes that you don't see too often in shows, and especially sci-fi shows.
Yeah.
So bringing that into it was really unique, and the visuals just for when they blew everything up was insane.
Crazy. Yeah. It's the it was a really ins it was a really crazy moment. The critique I had for it was somewhat nitpicky because it was such an impactful moment, but the Starbridge felt like this it felt like this giant engineering marvel that the universe had never seen. They kind of like presented that way, which it was. And I thought for it to kind of blow up that early felt like it felt like it could have been. And again, I don't know what the pace of the show is or how it relates to the books, but it feels like had that happened in like episode four, it would have been such a giant like, oh my God, the Starbridge is falling, you know? But we had just kind of been introduced to it in the show, so.
Yeah.
While they did kind of convey that impact and how it had to the world and stuff, it really didn't feel that impactful to us as an audience because it just seemed like this thing we had just been introduced to got destroyed.
Yeah.
So that was my one kind of critique with that, but it's not really critique if I'm judging based on what they're planning to do with the show. It's more just a critique on like, oh, that could have been more impactful had we built that place and that scene up
Yeah.
as this iconic power structure, in
Yeah.
that world.
Well, I think what happens is, and this is kind of touching upon episode three, is we didn't see how important the Star Bridge was until episode three,
Exactly.
that it was a beacon for the Emperors. It was a beacon for Cleon the First, who
Right.
was the one that started building it. And episode three touches upon like how important it is. And I do agree with you. Maybe if they did this in episode two, where they kind of flash back to, because episode two, I guess we could combine both episodes. I mean,
Yeah,
because
I think so.
there's certain things in episode one that wasn't talked about until episode two, where in episode two you have Lee Pace as a Brother Day going, we need to clean up what happened at the Starbridge because our citizens are seeing dead bodies coming through the atmosphere
Yeah.
burning up.
They said he said they only have to look up to see our ineptitude. They just have to look up to see the ineptitude. So, yeah.
And if they brought in that sequence where Cleon the First said, like, this is my legacy, this is who I am, it would have been more impactful of how important the Starbridge was. And to go with what you're saying, it would have given the audience like, oh crap, this is really, really important. This is why they're going so hardcore on it and
Yeah.
going insane to make sure that the people who destroyed it are brought to justice.
Yeah, because you don't know. They make vague allusions to it in the first episode where they say like how big it is, and I love the scenes where they're I love that they took the time to do the scenes where they're like, oh, it takes 14 hours to take the elevator down, and you really feel how much of an engineering marvel it is and
Yeah.
how important it is to that society and stuff like that. But like watching the first one, you're like, do these exist on every planet? Like, I don't know how common this is. Like, I don't know like
Yeah.
if this is how big of an iconic structure this is going forward. And had I gotten some of that stuff from that we got in episode three, where I start to realize that this was the first Cleon, this was like his legacy, his entire
Yeah.
his whole legacy and stuff. That and the concept of Imperial cloning, it would have impacted me so much more when it got destroyed and stuff. But like I said, I understand like if that's the domino that has to fall at the beginning to kind of start things in motion, I understand kind of kind of taking that route, but I did feel this, like, this kind of longing for, like, oh, I wish that would have hit me harder, that, you know, in that moment and stuff.
Yeah. Last thing about the destruction of the Star Bridge, because I know we got to, like, get that, definitely move on. When they were doing the destruction, you got to see it, like, blow up. One of the cars that we got, like, in first person view of it as it's going down, what got me was seeing, like, the fear and terror on the passengers' faces and, like, the glass shattering as soon as something hits it. That was a really unique perspective, because you don't see it from so many that type of point of view, because you always see it from, like, the outside, like, oh my god, look at all the stuff. You see it from the inside, but you don't see a small selection, like a car going down the elevator. You never really see something like that, seeing it destroy, the terror, the fear. So that was a really unique perspective that they did in episode one that I really enjoyed. Like, not their death and demise, but
no, I'm sure you loved that. I'm sure you loved like seeing all those people die. You were like, oh hell yeah, that's awesome. I completely agree. I thought that sequence was very violent. I loved it. They show the scope of the small family going through it, or the kind of blue collar worker going through it in the elevator. That really kind of hits home the stakes of it, and makes you feel like, oh wow, these were a lot of people that were murdered and stuff. Because shows like this have a tendency to just throw out, oh, 100 million people died, or 100,000 people died. It's just a number. But if you can show those people in those kind of situations, it makes it hit a little harder. So after the Star Bridge is destroyed, obviously they think that Harry had something to do with it, because he was just on trial talking about how the Empire would fall. And then lo and behold, the day after, this occurs. So there was obviously some suspicion of Harry having done this. And the whole episode is kind of this interrogation of the two ambassadors and Harry, and trying to figure out what they're going to do about, you know, the fallout, and how they're going to kind of maintain, what does he say? Enjoy the peace and the, what is the phrase? When he sees everyone enjoy, or respect the something and enjoy the peace, or something like that. I'm not 100% sure, but
yeah, I can't remember what it was.
They're trying to figure out how to maintain that control of the of the situation. So I did want to touch on real quick too, to kind of close out episode one, was the concept of Imperial cloning. I thought was super interesting. I hadn't seen that in anything before, and I thought that was really awesome. And I will say two things thematically. So the first one is, I thought the idea of the Imperial cloning was really cool, that there's like a kid and then a middle-aged and an older version. And when the older version dies, they clone the new version. It's just this kind of fulfilling cycle. It also explains the narcissism of the character. And as far as like, if any of us had been born in a situation like that, we would think our shit doesn't stink and we would be narcissistic. So it makes him almost like, it makes him almost, even though he's evil, it makes you understand him. Yeah, but you understand that point of view from him, and he doesn't feel like, he feels like more of a victim of that circumstance than like an evil person to me. So that's kind of what I got out of it.
And going back, like, I know we're jumping ahead to see episode three, but it's a really neat approach on how we see it now in episode one to what we see in episode three. Because there's two things I want to talk about that happen in episode three. When we get there, because the things that happened in episode one, and so there's two things I want to talk about. So I want to get to episode two now. Let's go.
So the last thing thematically before we dive into episode two is that what I loved about episode setting up with the trial with Harry and the Empire, I guess, is they are foils. So when you talk about like the protagonist and antagonist and how they're foils for each other, they're very similar, but they're extremely different. And that's kind of what makes them hate each other. So what I think is great is that Harry wants to use determinism to set up a foundation of knowledge so that they can push this further into the future. And what I found really kind of poetic about that difference of opinion is that that's what the Kleons are. They are each time a kid is born, he's setting up a foundation of new knowledge that's being taught by the past generations, and then building upon that into the next dynasty that they're going to be doing. So they have like the same goals. They just have different ways of achieving it. And I think whenever you have protagonists and antagonists as that, it makes for a really compelling story and a really compelling, you know, vision and stuff.
Yeah, it does. It's like using our nerdy stuff that's not sci-fi related, but like it's like Professor Xavier Magneto in the X-Men.
Right.
They both want mutant peace, and they both want peace in the world. One is working with mankind, another one is destroying mankind. And it's very unique perspective because they both have the same ideas and goals, but they different ways to get there.
Right. So let's go ahead and rock into Preparing to Live. It's episode 2. It was directed by Andrew Bernstein and also written by Josh Friedman and David S. Goyer. So they wrote the first two episodes here. So this is going to be the one where they actually talked the Klingon dynasty into being able to set up their foundation, but they have to be exiled to a planet far away to do it. So they get kind of exiled away.
Terminus.
Terminus is the planet that they end up going towards. So this is this kind of jumps forward from then to when they're actually on the way to Terminus and they're on the ship and they're kind of building the foundation on the ship and figuring out ways that they're going to establish that once they reach the Terminus, which is going to take a number of years. I forget exactly how long they said it was going to take. It was going to take a number of years for them to get from Trantor to Terminus. It also, like you said, is the interrogation scene where they're trying to figure out the fallout from the Starbridge and they're questioning the two ambassadors. One is Anacreon and Thespis, I think, are the two two very different warring cultures in near the Terminus systems, and they are suspected of being involved in the attack. So there's this kind of very intense interrogation that is going on Klingon about that. What did you think of episode 2? What kind of stood out to you about that episode?
One of the things that stood out to me about the episode was there's more to Gale than what meets the eye. Mm-hmm. Because this is one of the things that got me thinking that Gale might be a soothsayer or might be able to see the future or understand psychohistory better than anybody else. Mm-hmm. Because in the first episode, before the Starbridge started blowing up, she goes, "Something's wrong with the Starbridge." She looked up and she knew immediately that something was not right.
Yeah.
In this episode, when she's swimming, she looks up, she immediately noticed that something is not right, and she knew all hell was breaking loose. So that really gets me to thinking that Gale might understand psychohistory better than anybody else, better than Harry Seldon.
Yeah.
So it's a really unique way to see how she approaches certain situations. So this was really because it was in two parts. Because you have, for me right now, the Gale part was really, really intriguing because we got to see more of who she really is. Mm-hmm. In the budget meeting, she told him, like, why do we need to save one version of counting compared to thousands of other versions of counting? Because if we look at the,
I like that scene.
And it just shows like how, like, she comes from a small backwards planet, in lack of a better term, but they've been on the spaceship for so many years that she was able to catch up to how society really is.
Yeah.
And they did her really, really good where it shows that she evolved based on her surroundings, that now she's on a starship with other like-minded people, that she's evolved to that person. And it harkens back that she saw Starbridge, something's not right, starts blowing up. She's swimming, something's not right, and then all hell breaks loose.
Yeah. And, you know, they had been establishing too in the episodes that she's been in that she does this kind of meditative chant where she chants prime numbers and she's been chanting into the millions and stuff like that. I think it's really setting up, you know, if I was to forecast forward, it's setting up that she has some kind of superhuman pattern recognition, which is why she was able to solve that equation. And she's also just got this, she, like I said, she's got like her pattern recognition is so good that she intuits when things are off and things are maybe skewing from the way that they're supposed to go or something along those lines. So it seems to be setting that up here. I definitely agree. The whole thing with Gale being special was established with that, with her intuition, also with her being able to wake up during the jump drive sequence in the first episode as well, that no one else was able to. And one of the things we didn't touch on in the first one was the whole Salvor Hardin thing with on Terminus and her as the warden, which is dived into a little more in the next episode that we're going to talk about here, but it did establish that there's something special about that character too. So
yes,
Gale was definitely, it was kind of an episode of establishing her as kind of a very special character in there. I thought it was great. I love the scene where she's talking about base 10, base 12, base 27 counting and stuff. I thought that was cool because it really highlights how important diversity of perspective is. And the fact that she's coming from a less than prestigious world. She's able to see things through a viewpoint that makes a little more sense. And it really highlights like having different perspectives in there make the best decisions for the Foundation. Yep. So I thought that was really cool. It also broke down kind of how the ship, the Foundation works, what they're trying to establish. You kind of get a real feel for what the goals are there. And Jared Harris, I thought, was really good in the episode as well. Did anything else jump out to you? I know they obviously had the execution scene with Cleon that I thought was really intense. Especially that, you know, being as futuristic and sci-fi as the show is, for them to just do hanging, I felt was a really bold statement, in front of the followers and everything like that. But what did you think about that whole scene with the interrogation on the Cleon side and then the genocide and execution that followed?
Yo, that was crazy, because that kind of reminds me of like military punishment, where if you screw up, you see everybody else suffer and you have to bear witness to it. And it felt like that, where somebody screwed up on those two planets and the ambassadors go like, it doesn't matter. You guys are here. You're going to have to suffer this. You're going to have to see your home worlds be bombarded and destroyed, and there's nothing you can do about it. Everyone you know is dead. That's it. And it just really made you feel like the punishment was just, you're now left alone. You should have been able to to figure this stuff out before anybody else. That's it. You're the last of your kind. Whoever's out there.
Right. It really also drove in that point of I don't know if they killed everyone off on those planets, because he did say go back home and like tell them why this happened. So I think they killed off like a giant portion of their population and stuff like that. But it really drove home Cleon's character, either all three of them, Dawn, Day, and Dusk, because they are the same kind of person for the most part. But it really drove in that everything is about optics and stature for them, because they've obviously been raised in this recurring dynasty over and over again. So everything is just about how are you perceived to your people and about the optics and stuff. So it didn't matter that maybe none of them were guilty. It was like, something happened to us. I have to make a bold statement back. And it really kind of fleshed out that idea of kind of the tit for tat militarily that occurs in the real world too, where it's just sometimes the retribution for something seems to outweigh what actually happened, you know, to begin with. So yeah, I thought that scene was great. I'm trying to think of anything else really different. I mean, obviously the way it ended, there was a giant plot thing that we can get to. The one thing I didn't like about this episode, and I will say too, I think episode 2 was probably the weakest of the three for me. But I understand it kind of had to do a lot of setting up, so it didn't seem that way. But the one thing I've disliked in the last two episodes are the romance sequences. They feel so like weird. And
it was forced,
out of place, and forced, and they feel very derivative. There's nothing interesting uniting the characters. It's just like, oh, you're gonna like this guy now, even though there's nothing. And then they have these really cheesy romance sequences that I have not liked at all.
No, that episode 2 and 1, which spoiler alert, Gail and Raish are a couple, and it does feel forced. It does feel like
they're just a couple. Yeah. Okay. Like, all right.
And that was the one thing I didn't like between episode 1 and 2, was how much it jumped so far ahead without explaining anything. Because episode 1, we know that they're being exiled to Terminus. The next thing we know, they're aboard the spaceship for years now. You're going like, what? Okay, I guess it's a thing now. But you don't realize that, because you see Gale swimming and Raish is there, and next thing you know, they're banging in the pool. You're like, where did this develop? Like, you don't see them like interacting. You don't see them going like, hey, girl?
And they're not just banging in the pool. They're intensely in love. Like, they're just like, they're not just having like a fling or like, you know, screwing around. It's like they make it so like they've intensely in love. They're soulmates or something. And you're just like, how am I supposed to buy that? We've only seen them like interact for like 2 minutes on screen to this point and stuff. I felt a lot of whiplash, and it also brought up the one quick point. It also brought up that unadaptable thing where I was like, wow, if we're in a TV show, which is generally just an 8-hour long season, and there's a lot of seasons to come, and they feel the need to speed through this, I can see now why people thought this was so unadaptable for TV, because it does feel like whiplash. Yeah. Like you had the first one, and then you're like, wow, what is happening? This seems so fast.
And one of like it kind of touches into episode three because they do have like the time jump and things like that. But like with episode two, you kind of see some like the after effects of what happened when Starlight, the Starbridge. I'm always gonna get it confused. The Starbridge explodes. So you see that in episode two, you see the after effects, you see them on the ship, and you kind of have like have a sense of time, and it kind of makes sense, but you don't know where in the timeline you are because like for them to be madly in love in an intense relationship, you know that's been years or months, but you don't feel it. You feel like it's like the next day or like a few weeks later that all this stuff is happening. And when you're still dealing with the ramifications of the executions, the bombardment, they're on the outer rim. Like, how long did it take? How long were they investigating this? Like, it just felt like there wasn't, they didn't establish a timeline or a time frame. And that's was the most jarring thing, because when you get into the episode, she's swimming in a pool and they're talking about careers and months and like how they were been on the ship for so long. You never felt like that you've been on the ship with them. You just felt like you just kind of like popped in and you're supposed to know what's happening.
And part of me likes that. Part of me likes the not handholding and just you're in it and let's try to catch up kind of thing. But yeah, part of me, especially with the emotional relationship stuff, is just like this wasn't earned. I feel like this is just like they're trying to shove this down our throats, and like there was no kind of setup for it and stuff. So I was really critical of that. But the episode goes into at the end, which is this jarring conclusion. Going into episode three, is she's swimming, she's counting prime numbers, she feels something off. Like you said, she intuits that something is off in the universe. She gets out and she goes to Harry's office and she finds her soulmate at this point, Ra'sh, has stabbed Jared Harris's character, Harry Seldon, in the heart, and he's dead. And she is not supposed to be there. So when Ra'sh was so adamant that what are you doing here? You're not supposed to be here. It made me seem like this is something that Harry was aware of, because it seems like something where he said, this is what's gonna happen, this is what's gonna happen, and she threw a wrench in the entire situation. But did you get that
Which,
feeling too, that this was like orchestrated by Harry, that he knew he was going to die and this was how it's gonna happen, but he thought that this had to happen to set up a certain outcome?
no, but it did touch upon something that they said in this episode at the end, dealing with the vault, how they weren't able to predict or take
And
into
real quick,
consideration.
for those who don't know, the vault, the thing on Terminus, the big sci-fi object that has a null field around it. It was one of the first things introduced in the show, but it's this big, mysterious, kind of reminds me of the monolith from 2001.
It's just a monolith there, and nobody knows what it's there for, but it has
But
a null
yeah.
field.
But go ahead. What was the point about that?
Was that no one predicted that the main character from episode three, would not be affected by that null field. And I think that correlates with like how Harry was able to almost predict the future, but like there's always going to be gaps. There's always going to be like probabilities that you just hope will never affect it. And that should be one of the ones where like Harry had to die. And Ra'sh was like, she'll never know if I kill him because I could just whatever. So it shows that nothing's predictable, like everything's still up in the air.
Yeah,
And
it gives the illusion that nothing's predictable, but again, I feel like Harry, I don't think Ra'sh just killed Harry. Like, I feel like there was more to it, where it's like he knew he was gonna die and this is how it had to happen, because it had to set into course some kind of event that's going to, I guess what they were going for in the first episode was minimize the time that they're in shitty, like a shitty war-stricken world,
Go
you
from
know?
like 1,000 years to 500 years.
So I think this was orchestrated by him. He knew too much about what was happening to kind of not see this coming. But it was definitely a shocking occurrence. I didn't expect that to happen in episode two. I hope Jared Harris is still involved in some capacity, be it flashbacks or something along those lines, because I think he's a brilliant actor. But it was definitely a shocking moment for me.
And episode two, outside of the death of Harry, most of it was kind of you just saw the how the day-to-day life was on the ship. You saw the how it was on Synax and just things like that. Oh no, Synax is where Gale came from. Trantor, where like Trantor being part of the Emperor, seeing how they viewed society. The one thing that really got me interested, and you talked about romances and you talked about relationships. Mm-hmm. And I think this might be a good segue to episode 3, depending on like how you want to go with it. But the relationship with the Kleons, or like Brother Dawn, Dusk, Day, and the android, like that is such a unique relationship. And you kind of see it in episode 1 and 2 where she dotes on Dawn, where she's babying him, always being there with him no matter what. And then with episode 3, she's always with Dusk. Mm-hmm. And it kind of like makes you think, like, how is she having all this time to be with one and the other at this simultaneously?
Right.
And I think that touches upon with what we talked about with like the relationships. And all of a sudden you're like, you're supposed to like, okay, yeah, they're in love. Just, you know, they're in love. Just go with it.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was established, I think, in episode 2 that she was she's an android, or she's like a robot. There's also a subline about, or a, what's the subplot about?
Yeah. The android war.
Yeah. Yeah. How AI is like, doesn't exist anymore because of something that happened in the past. They haven't really alluded to specifics, but her kind, she's like the last of like the androids that they use for her. But what I got from that is that she's a matriarchal figure that exists through all the timelines with them, and she's like a mother figure for them as they go through this imperial cloning thing. So I like the actress. I thought she was really good in it. She's fantastic. But yeah, you do kind of question like how exactly all of this works. I remember one of the things that I questioned too was, I was just like, do they just not have sex? They don't have like heirs or like any kind of family aside from themselves. I'm wondering if they're like sterilized at birth because they need to focus on their duties as Imperial Command or something like that. But
like, you think like they'll have concubines and different things like that, because you see how like egotistical, how like, I'm forgetting the word, narcissistic they are.
Narcissistic,
Because you see that in episode 3 a lot, because when they go to the Starbridge, like the remaining Starbridge, and they see the first recorded video of Kleon the First, you see at that time, Brother, who we knew from episode 1 and 2, Brother Dawn, now is Brother Day.
Uh-huh.
You see him like, man, he was majestic. He was like, oh, so powerful. And it's like, that's you. That is a version of you. And you can see them admiring themselves. Like, man. Yeah.
That's what I was going to say, too, is the height of narcissism would be if when they come of age, they screw each other.
Bro, it reminds me so much of American Psycho. The height of
narcissism.
Like American Psycho, where Patrick Bateman had to have mirrors while he was like with prostitutes, and he would just look at himself like doing his thing. It just reminded me of that. I was like, yo, I don't think these guys love anyone but themselves.
Yeah. So that's what I'll say too, is I get that too. And I get that that's a very, very unlikable trait for a character. It's just weird because Lee Pace is such a likable as an actor for that character too. But also I get it. Cause I'm like, dude, if I was raised and I was the seventh line of me, because I just keep making myself because I'm such a smart, fucking awesome person, like I would be such a dick. You know what I mean? I would be such an amazing asshole. So it's this weird thing where like I kind of feel for them, because I'm like, they never had a chance to be a nice person, because when you're born, just constantly told that you're the king of the galaxy and that you're so important that when you die they're gonna make another of you to just keep going over and over again. That's just the height of like, you know, patting someone's ego. So the fact that they had that ego isn't at all weird to me. I'm just like, oh well, that makes sense that he would just kill random people all the time because they're ants to him, you know what I mean?
And it's crazy like when you say that, because this is what I wanted to touch upon, was in this episode, we saw that Kleon the First was so pissed off that he wouldn't get credit for completing the Star Bridge.
Yeah.
And you see him like, and he's talking about it. He goes, this is my legacy and I will never see it complete.
Right.
And so my successor is going to get the credit for it and not me. And that just ties in so well with his,
even though it is you, just, it's not you, but it is, you're still a bitch about it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And it just, and that just like really goes deep, deep, deep into like the egotistical, narcissistic nature of who he is as a person and as a character, that he doesn't realize that he's such a son of a bitch, pardon my French, until he's about to die, where he's like, I did this all wrong. And you don't see that until when Brother Dusk, or no, is it Brother? No, it's What's the last one? Brother
I know you
Darkness.
can't keep track. Yeah, Brother
Yeah.
Darkness. Yeah.
When Brother Darkness is about to walk into like the incinerator ray, he doesn't realize that his entire life was meaningless and pointless until he's about to be evaporated because he realized he did nothing. He has
Right.
done nothing for society.
Yeah.
All he did was just keep bringing the same traditions, just keep doing the same things over and over and over. And it was nothing new, no advancement of
Yeah,
technology
yeah.
because, and you think about like the Star Bridge. Okay, the Star Bridge was built over thousands upon years ago. That was still like their crowning achievement. It's like, we built the Star Bridge. And it's like, well,
Right.
did you guys do anything else?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So that kind of brings us to episode three. So episode three, we're gonna kind of dive into that here. That is gonna be the most recent one. That's the most we're mo the one
Yes.
we're most fresh on. That's gonna be The Mathematician's Ghost, which I think is a really cool title for that, considering what the episode was. This is
Yes.
my favorite episode of the three, I think, so far. I really like the first one, but I think this one's probably my favorite. This one was directed by Alex Graves. It was written by Olivia Purnell, and it came out today, actually. So
Oh,
came out earlier today.
before I forget, the director for episode one, Ruber Sanders, we didn't talk about this, and this is my fault. He did Ghost in the Shell.
Oh, cool.
So he is familiar with
The
the
American
sci-fi.
version, like the
Yeah, the Scarlett Johansson,
did
like
you almost say unfortunately?
yeah, unfortunately, but it works because it's a sci-fi show that he was
Right.
he's into sci-fi.
It had great effects too, that
It
movie, if
did.
I remember correctly, so.
Alex Bernstein, he did a lot of like shows. He's done the Get Down, Ozark, Pan Am, Battle
Oh,
Creek,
cool.
Fear the Walking Dead, The Outsider. So he knows these type of shows. So he's a traditional television director, knows how to get in, get out, get it done. Alex Graves, his career, he's done a lot of TV shows. One of his big shows was Altered Carbon. So it's
Oh,
another
okay.
director that's familiar with sci-fi. So one thing
Right,
so
right.
far that Foundation's gone right is the directors know sci-fi. They've done sci-fi
Right.
before, so they understand the medium. So that's been a really cool thing. And I think that's actually helped some of the shows. But yeah, sorry, I didn't mean to like
From. Yeah, no, that's great. Yeah, because I think that's a through line. If all of those directors, a lot of them have kind of basis in sci-fi, they completely understand that. And that kind of leads into, I think, a lot what a lot of those directors do. It kind of leads into not just episode three, but all the episodes. The production design, I think, has been really,
Yeah.
really interesting. What I really love is that they are not using anything digital. I don't know if you've
No.
noticed that too. There's no dials, there's no like or not there's no dials, there's no like there's no screens, there's no readouts and all that
Yes.
kind of stuff. Everything is very tactile and analog. It's one of the things I really loved about Blade Runner 2049 when it came out was
Oh, beautiful movie.
right. So when the first Blade Runner came out, it took place in 2019, I think.
Yeah.
And when 2049 was being adapted, they said, okay, well, if 2019 we didn't have screens then, because in Blade Runner they just used like analog equipment, we would just see extensions of that about 30 years. So they didn't rely on anything coming up with screens or like all these kind of different stuff. They made these tactile, physical, analog props that I thought were
Yeah.
gorgeous for that movie and really made it feel different. And they're doing that in this one as well.
Yeah.
I almost tried to look for screens and dials and all that kind of like I keep saying dials, like digital readouts. And
Yeah.
I didn't find any anywhere. They were all just very tactile. They used the sand and all that kind of stuff. I thought it was really cool.
Yeah, and in this episode we got to see them argue about a clock. Like, what is the best way to measure time? A water
Right.
clock or a sundial? And that really shows how deep in that they're thinking about how are we going to preserve mankind? How are we going to preserve knowledge? Like, which clock will work better? And they
And
discussed it,
yeah.
and it was
Which is
really neat.
most likely to be to survive if something
Yeah.
happened, you know? Yeah.
So, and using that, and it wasn't, they did not CGI a water clock or a sundial. You actually saw a real sundial and a real water clock, and you're going,
Right. And
okay.
a digital readout wasn't even an option. Like when they say
Yeah.
like, oh, what's a clock? It wasn't even an option. So I don't even know if that even exists as a technology in the world at all. I don't even think they're capable of that or they've thought of that. But yeah, sundial and water clock is a great summation of the point I'm making, which is just using these very analog physical tech. It makes the movie feel so much more sci-fi. It makes it feel so much more thought out, you know, because the easy way would just be to have a control room with a bunch of screens. You know,
Yeah,
that'd be the easy thing to do.
and then like a battery that never runs out. Like, oh yeah, this device
Right.
never runs out of power, so you can use
Right.
it forever. It's like, okay, cool. That defeats the purpose of what you're doing by rebuilding, by building a foundation that society could come back to. Because
Right.
if you could create technology that can never be destroyed, then why are you doing what you're doing?
Exactly. Yeah. So I really like that. So the episode three starts. It does a lot of time jumps in this one. So you have this is a
Oh,
very
God,
one you have to
yes.
pay attention to. I think it starts 400 years prior with Cleon the One. He's talking about his legacy, like you said, about the Star Bridge and all that stuff, and the matriarch. I forget the character's name. Do we have that? Like the character's name for that kind of maternal figure?
Give me one second.
So Demerzel. So
The
Laura Byrne plays Eto Demerzel. She is the Emperor's last surviving androids from the ancient robot wars, it says. So he's sitting with her, and she's kind of the mother, the matriarch. She's also the advisor to them as well. So she kind of acts and puts on all those hats, but she's talking to him about his legacy. And it really focuses on Brother Dusk. So Terrence Mann's role in this is very expanded. It's really half an episode about him and half an episode about Salvo Hardin on Terminus. But I thought he did a fantastic job in the episode. I love seeing the lore of how the Imperial cloning stuff works being kind
Yes.
of unraveled for us, and the different traditions and stuff that they follow and rituals that they follow throughout that process. I love kind of them peeling back that layer of storytelling there. So
Yeah.
I thought that was great. It starts with that, then it jumps 400 years in the future where we have another Brother Dusk.
Yeah.
It's really hard, and again, it goes into that unadaptable feeling. It's really hard to
Yeah.
figure out where you are in space because they're clones, so there's nothing to differentiate one from the other. You're like,
Yeah.
am I looking at Cleon 1 or am I looking at Cleon 14? I have no fucking idea, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And like how we went with Brother Dusk, we got to see how like the cloning cycle works, that it's brother, you have Brother Dawn, Brother Day, Brother Dusk, and Brother Darkness. And as soon as Brother Darkness comes around, okay, Brother Dawn is born, and then each one moves on to their into their new role. And it's really unique. Like I know I said it before, but when you see Brother Darkness, where he comes to terms with who he is, you see the change of from when he was Brother Day to Brother Dawn, that he realizes that he doesn't need to be such a jackass. He doesn't need to be so strict. He doesn't need to be so formulaic, so regulated, that he could just be chill, understand the vibes. Because you see him where like the seamstress is like messing up, like trying to like do the suit, and you see him like fidgeting. He goes, "Give the girl a shot."
Yeah, he's much more forgiving and not as egotistical. He's matured, and it's really
Yeah.
sad that it takes him until he's about to die to do
Yeah, because
that,
you see in the earlier episodes when the painter was just talking to Harry Seldon, he
but
kills him just like, "You're dead. You're useless to me." The two ambassadors, he's like, "I'm gonna kill you." You see them like he's just bring the whip, just any violence will be the answer. But then he's facing death, and you just see a complete change of person. And that was the unique thing, where you just see him like with the seamstress, like he's scared, he's nervous. Any other time, he's like, "Dead, done, get rid of him." He's like, "Nah, just bring the girl. Let's go. Let's see what she could do."
It's really likable too. I thought it was really powerful, like you said. And even when he at the end scene, they don't hit you over the head with the themes. It really comes through in the performance and stuff as well, and the dialogue. But he's holding Cleon, the next Cleon, the baby, and he's holding him a little longer. And I got from that he's questioning whether this is the good idea, whether this whole thing of hit, because like you said, when he thinks back to himself dealing with people, like either blowing up the guy that wrote the painting or killing those ambassadors, even though they most likely didn't have anything to do with the attacks, when he thinks back to that, he's obviously second guessing that now because he's forgiving to the guy and he's saying maybe this isn't the way to go. So I think he's kind of resenting his past self. So he's looking at himself as a kid and he's saying, is this really like, are we just going to keep doing this, you know? And kind of questioning that. And I thought that was a really powerful scene, the whole thing about the way that they do the ritual and stuff like that, and him walking into the light. I thought it was really interesting that they have a finite life cycle. So I thought it was really interesting that like there's a day where they reach a certain age and they just kill themselves as opposed to just living to where they die of natural causes. I thought that was really compelling, and it kind of just puts a bow on the entire cloning sequence of it's just a loop, you know?
Yeah, and what gets me is like, and this is where we get to see like how big of a character what's her name? Eto is, the android, because she goes, "I never forget, I never forget, I never forget." And she how cavalier she was when Brother Darkness came in, is like seeing how the cloning process was, And she goes, "Oh, we don't allow anyone to come see the cloning process," but she does nothing to stop him. She's like, "But come on in, let's watch it." So it's a really, you got to see that for the first time, where you start questioning, like, whose side is she really, is she on? Because at this point, you now see that she's Brother Darkness's like confidant, that she was always with him the entire way. But in the first two episodes, you saw it was Brother Dawn that she was always with.
Yes, she's going to be a really interesting character going forward, as far as she has the ear of all of them. She understands the inner workings of them to a degree that I don't even think they do, because she's mothered iterations of them past for generations. So she knows things about them that I don't even think they know about themselves. And she's going to be a really interesting character because of her background with the kind of AI wars that they allude to and all that kind of stuff. There's obviously some kind of motivation or something for her to potentially not be as trustworthy as they're kind of letting on in these seasons and stuff as well. So I think she's going to be a really important linchpin going forward, as far as like what they're going to how things are going to happen. And they allude to in this one too, as far as jumping forward, where you see another Brother Dawn and he's erasing the mural, the famous mural, and he's erasing it, and it looks like this is happening towards the fall that Harry has established and stuff as well. So they're hopping around at different times on. It's really hard to keep your head in one space. I think I followed it, but I'm still not 100% sure. It's probably an episode that we would need to rewatch to really understand
For sure.
where
It was
everything's taking place.
too many time jumps, because it went for like 19 years, 400 years, 36 years. Like, it wasn't like an exact, like, okay, we know where we're going here. It was just way too all over the place. Where, but the themes of this episode, I feel they hit more pronounced because it's life, death, legacy, that type of stuff. And very few sci-fi shows talk about this type of things, because the history of sci-fi shows is normally more along the lines of like happy-go-lucky. They don't really touch upon like deep-rooted themes. Very few sci-fi go that route. Like Blade Runner was one that talked about free will, determinism, what is life.
What is
The
human?
Ma yeah, Matrix kind of talked about like what do we perceive as real and what is the real world.
A lot of Alex
And
Garland's stuff dives into the
yeah, I
philosophy and
mean,
stuff too.
Arrival was a mate. Did Alex Garland do Arrival?
No, Alex Garland did he did
Ex Machina?
Annihilation, he did Ex Machina.
That's okay. Yeah, like Annihilation and Ex Machina were two amazing films that I really do think me and you need to do a deep dive on those two on a
Yeah, that'd be
different.
fun. I
Because,
love both of those movies.
but you see those things and like they touch upon themes, but you could probably count on both hands sci-fi films that really touch upon these type of stuff of what life legacy, like with Brother Darkness. He realized, like, hey, maybe we need to stop this cloning thing to let society move on, because we're keeping it in the past. But when we get to the future, where they're on the Terminus, you see how society has evolved to a completely different thing, where it's just a natural order, like replacing, but it's not the same person replacing the same task. Like the warden of Terminus is viewed as this powerful position, and if Cleon was still in charge, he would just put himself always in charge of the warden. But they handed it all over to somebody else, and you see a different approach to how they're going to protect the colony, protect the stuff. So it does touch upon like a lot of these things. And this episode, The Mathematician Ghost, it sucked timeline, like putting everything in the timeline, but it really did make you think about what is a society, what makes the society great? Is it just the same, reliving the same glory days, or moving on and suffering the ebbs and highs of what society really is, where sometimes it's really good, sometimes it's really bad.
And I want to get into the second half of this too with Salvo Hardin before I kind of go over my overall theme,
Oh,
like the things I
yes.
picked up on the themes for the show. So they cut to Salvo Hardin on Terminus, and this is the warden, the person that is kind of special as far as her relationship to the Null Field, which is that the vault, I guess, the monolithic item on that she has some kind of special relationship to it. She's able to kind of what's that?
Yo, okay. So
Oh, I was like, am I spoiling something? Because this is a
no, not spoiling
spoiler.
something. It my synapses connected something. So in episode two, we saw that they were talking about like the fertile eggs and things like that. and how one of the cast or one of the crew members was pregnant, and she said that I wanted to feel like a baby grow inside of me. I want to know the experiences because we don't know if we're going to survive or not. Could, what's her name? Salvador. Could Salvador be a descendant from Gale, and that's why the null field doesn't affect her?
Possibly. Like, again, I don't know, because I think if you like broke down the chronology, I don't know. She seems like she's older, right? Like maybe mid-20s, 30s, something like that. She doesn't seem
but
too
that's
young, right?
36 years after they landed onto Terminus.
Is it? Okay, because I thought it was like 36 years from when they were traveling to... Like, that's the thing is, like, I don't understand the timeline per se. It's definitely possible. Like, I can see there's something different about Salvor as far as her her relationship to the vault and stuff like that. So it is possible that maybe she's a descendant. There's a million different, like, theoretical possibilities about what could be happening. Maybe if we do an episode where we just dive into like what we think possible theories might be, because we could do that for like probably 4 hours with the show.
Oh, dude, God, yeah. This is you're just talking about certain things, because then I remembered in episode two they were talking about like the eggs and like how she's like, are you gonna report that you're pregnant? There's a scene where like she's drinking wine, she's like, oh, pass me the wine, and Gail's like, you're pregnant, why are you drinking wine? And she still does it anyway. It just clicked, like, yo, maybe Salvor and Gale have something, have a connection. They're
connected somehow. Yeah.
But yeah,
into that too with her, with her seeing if she's able to mathematically kind of do the same thing that Gale did. So, and have that kind of same special quality to her. But they show her. So now there's this big bustling colony at this point for the Foundation. This is kind of 36 years, like you said, into the future, I believe. So they're showing this bustling colony. She is the Warden of the Wild. She's essentially like the hunter that kind of keeps beasts and all that kind of things out of the colony and protects the colony from any kind of natural occurrences that occur on Terminus. She's establishing that she has a fascination with this vault. She's drawn to it as a kid and all this kind
of
stuff.
The age of four.
I love the actor that plays her dad. I love him in everything he does. He is awesome. I want to get his name actually, because I really do like that actor. I think this was episode three.
It was Clark Peterson. Clark Peters. Sorry.
Yeah, I love Clark Peters. I love that he's playing her dad in this. This was a fun episode.
Oh, it's Peter Clark.
Okay. I love this episode mainly because this one feels like the first episode that kind of slows down and you really get to kind of flesh out the world and the lore behind it. Even on Terminus, kind of how everything works, as far as like how the society works, what their job roles are, kind of the more day-to-day stuff. It's not as much of a whiplash fast thing, especially in the earlier episodes with the Cleon thing. You're able to kind of see more of the day-to-day of how this kind of Imperial cloning system works, and kind of they flesh that out. So I like this episode in that it slowed things down. But with Salvor Hardin, her character is trying to figure out, halfway through the episode, we're trying to figure out why the null field is expanding. Something has happened with the vault and the null field is expanding, and we don't know what's causing it. But at the same time that this occurs, they find out that there are enemy ships in the atmosphere hovering above the surface, and they're trying to figure out why that is and kind of what that's regarding. So that kind of sets up this episode for her character. And I liked all of that stuff. I thought that I really loved the production design of the colony and how I was just like, how did they shoot all this? Like, I don't know if they're doing like the Mandalorian thing with like the, you know what I mean? But I was just like, how are they shooting all this stuff?
This was filmed in Ireland.
Wow, man. That's it. The sets must have been gigantic for this show.
What I liked about this episode, like, cause you got to see him crash the ship and stuff like that, and they built society, but like, you could see it, like how they would build society from the ship. Mm-hmm. Because when Salvor goes into the ship, you can see that they stripped it for certain parts, certain things. Her mother, who I think is like the governor of the colony, you see her window as a certain shape. So when she goes into the ship, you see the same designs that's in her window in the ship. Yeah. So the consistency, and whoever is the script supervisor and the production designer, they did an amazing job of keeping everything consistent of like, how would they build this in a planet where they don't have equipment to terraform, they don't have equipment to mine, they don't have any of this stuff, how would they build this society? And you see a window that is exactly the same that's in the starship. So that was something that was really cool that I really did enjoy.
Yeah, that's interesting too, because I didn't catch that. Like, I know that they showed the ship crashing, but I remember thinking, like, what are we seeing here? And I didn't put together that this was when they finally got the Terminus for the first time. They crashed the ship on the surface, and that they kind of, now that you say that, it makes sense that they would just utilize all of the stuff on that ship and kind of scrap it for parts to kind of build out this colony and stuff. So I thought that was really interesting. I love the slower pace of this episode. I didn't like the romance thing in this one as well.
Yeah.
I also felt like I was just introduced to this person and now they're just like this in love couple.
Yeah.
It seems like they're just trying to get through that as fast as humanly possible. But that's one of the things I didn't like.
Yeah, like they bring this random dude who's like, oh yeah, he comes from the stars. He's 70 years old, but he was been cryogenically frozen for most of travel all his life. Mm-hmm. So he's like technically only like 25 or 28 or some esoteric number of like hot type stuff. And the kids love him because he gives them chocolates, but they're like, oh, we don't want chocolate. We want beer.
Yeah.
And you're like, what? Like six, like 12 year olds, like give us beer.
Yeah. I don't know what kind of what parenting they're doing on this, this planet, but their kids want to drink really early. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh no, that was just it. I was like,
So Harden has been seeing the episode ends. Harden has been seeing this little kid. I don't know if this is a figment of her imagination or if this is an actual little kid, but she's chasing this little kid. He runs into the derelict ship that they've been scrapping for parts, the ship that they came in on. And she finds this monster or this alien kind of beast that is there with an arrow on its shoulder, and then the Anacreans. I think the Anacreans are the ones with the bows, right? In the first episode.
Yeah, the Anacreans. Yes.
The Anacreans are they take her gun from her, and they're holding her at arrow point, I guess. I loved the beast. I was sitting there going, dude, the CGI this looks really good. I was just like, how are they affording this for a TV show? But it all looks so great between the crash, the ship crash, her little land speeder stuff. The beasts, the aliens, they all look so great in the show.
The land speeder, at one point, I thought it was fake. I was like, I could see how cheap the CGI was. I see where they cut costs. They turned off the lights. They're like, nope, never mind. It's supposed to look like that. Okay, we're good. The lights made it look fake. I was like, never mind.
Yeah, I was nerding out, in all the episodes, I was nerding out at just like how great everything looks. Even like, and when I say production design, it's like the actual art direction. And like, I loved the, when Cleon in the beginning of this episode is standing in front of those windows and there's like three circles on top of it. Like, dude, that looks so cool. And their passageways in Cleon's world are all like circular and stuff. And, It all feels intentional. It all feels like the production designer put so much thought into the history and the lore behind this and why these design choices would be made. And it all feels very lived in and real. I love that stuff about this one as well.
Yeah. And even you touched upon the artwork, how like they got rid of it. But even the artwork has that impactfulness. Like, it's not there just to be there. It's there because it has a meaning and purpose. And one thing I like about the show so far is everything that they put on screen has a meaning and a purpose. It's not just there just to be there.
It's intentional.
And I enjoy shows like that because that means the production design, everyone worked together to build the show, and they built it from what we see. They built like everything has a reason. Everything has a purpose. And I love that. The tracks where she was talking about like how the force field, you see the tracks, she talks about those tracks, and then it foreshadows the creature that she saves.
Yeah.
So it's a really, they don't bring something in for no reason at all. Everything has a purpose and everything has a reason. And I love it. And I love when shows do that.
Yeah, it's great. So the episode ends with her being held at arrow point from the Anacreans who have landed in Terminus space, even though they're not allowed to by the Imperial Edict, I think is what they said. So
yeah.
They're landed there. They're holding a knife at arrow point, and that's kind of where the episode ends. So leading into episode four, do you have any kind of predictions on where we're going to go in episode four? I think we're going to revisit Gail Dornick, because last time we saw her, she was ejected from that ship.
Yep.
I think they're going to show her character and kind of show what happens to kind of piece those together. But
yeah, like the thing with this episode I thought was the most disappointing was they didn't address Harry's killing. They just kind of like glossed over it or just pretended it didn't happen. It's like, next thing we know, they're on Terminus, and it's like, wait, what happened? Was there a trial? Did they, like, what happened to Raish? What happened to Gale?
Yeah, there weren't any allusions to that. Yeah, I totally get what you're saying.
So I think episode number four is going to talk about those things. I think episode number four is going to address Gale, Raish, why that happened, and then the after effects of the what are they called again? Ankarian and Assyrian?
The Anacreans?
Anacreans, thank you.
Yeah,
the Anacreans, like, they're gonna address, like, how the Anacreans are on that planet. Why are they there?
Yeah.
And what's the Vault's purpose? But I think they're gonna start explaining a little bit more of the questions that we're wondering, like, what happened to Gale?
Yeah.
The Anacreans, why are they there? Like, what brought them there? What made them want to come to a desolate planet that has nothing?
My prediction is that Gale is with the Anacreans. That's my prediction, is that she's going to be with them on the planet. Something happened that when the null field expanded, she's coming there to, like, do something with the null field potentially or whatever. I think they're kind of laying breadcrumbs to that. So that's what I think is going to happen in the next episode. But yeah, I think we're just going to see a lot of that stuff flesh out as far as how she got there. But I think it makes sense that if she's ejected, somehow she ends up with the Anacreans.
Yeah.
And she stays on their planet, and then she's coming back now, you know, to the vault because something has activated or something has changed. Now,
I have to ask you a question. In episode one, when Gale figures out how to open Harry's cube, like, get the information on there, he asked her, how many times did it take you? Oh, twice. In episode three, we saw the current, like, governor of the colony activate his cube as if it was nothing. So I'm curious, did Harry teach her, or did they have to look at, like, old footage? Like, how did she know how to activate his cube?
That's a great point. Yeah. So I, because the activation is definitely strange, because I don't know if maybe she just happened upon it or figured it out somehow, or maybe just tried forever and got it or something along those lines. But yeah, that I have no idea. I think, I think if Gale had taught her, then she would know that Gale Dornick is alive somewhere. So I don't think that that's the case. So it must have been something she potentially learned from Harry before he passed. Because she was going to be leading the colony or something, that he told her how it operated and how it worked. Along those lines. But that's the only thing that really makes sense to me, because I thought it was just him and Gale that knew how to do it, you know?
Yeah, and, like, I'm sorry, like some of the stuff, like, as we're talking about it, I'm remembering, like, wait, how did... And it's not plot holes, because the series hasn't completed yet, so we can't say, oh, there's a plot hole there. Mm-hmm. But it makes you wonder, like, how did she learn how to do it?
It's raising questions.
When at the time only two people know how to do it, which is Gale and Harry. Harry's dead and Gale's in space. Like, so when did they teach him? And that correlates to, like, your biggest issue and my biggest issue is the time jumps, the in-betweens. What is happening there? Like, I know you don't need to explain everything, but, like, we might need, like, a little montage, like, Sylvester Stallone, like, running on a treadmill.
It may do the thing where, like, you know, later on in the season, like, it fills all those gaps and you're like, okay, this is satisfying. But yeah, as of right now, it does feel, you do feel like you're not kind of grounded. You just feel like you're kind of spinning and you're like, wait, where am I? What time am I? When am I? Like, I don't know what's going on.
Yeah.
And all that kind of stuff.
And that's, like, my biggest gripe with the series. Like, I guess this is, like, sending off time, but, like, this is my biggest gripe with the series, because we're told all these amazing things. We have all these beautiful visuals, but we're not told how they correlate together, because there's too many jumps. There's too many gaps. The acting's spot on. The acting's a 10 out of a 10. Mm-hmm. The music's a 10 out of 10. Like, everything is so wonderfully designed, shown, but the execution, you're just like, how does it connect? Like, we have so many different parts that are so beautifully done.
Yeah.
They can stand alone as their own little thing, but, like, how do they all connect? Because we need the connections.
And my hope is that the filmmakers, like, my hope is that Friedman and David Goyer, they know this, and they're like, just hang in there, guys. It's all gonna mix. You know what I mean? Like, because I think it is something that it seems like it's intentionally fast paced. It seems like they're trying to get to something. They're trying to get us somewhere. So I do feel that, but my hope is just that they're kind of waiting, having us hold out and say, like, this is all going to make sense. This is all going to, like, click. You're going to feel a lot more secure by the end of the season. So
yeah,
it's very dense, and that's what I worry about. General audiences going like checking out is going like, wait, there's so much shit that's being thrown at me constantly, yeah, as far as the time period, all the names, all of the culture, the different planets and how they relate to each other. It's like information waterboarding in these first three episodes.
Yeah.
So I can see that turning some people off, but I feel invested. I feel like,
oh yeah.
Yeah. I definitely feel like I want to see where it's going. Cause I do feel like they're going to kind of fill in those gaps, especially people that have seen the full season have said it's great. So I think that, that satisfaction is kind of inevitable. I think at some point they're going to kind of fill those gaps for us.
Yeah, I hope they do, because there's so many things about this series that I want them to explore more.
Mm-hmm.
One is the religion that Gale was into. I know the name's gonna like attack us and like be like, ah.
Synax is the planet. I think it's whatever the religion is on that planet there.
Yeah, yeah. So whatever the Synax religion is, like, it's really unique because you see. Well, in the series, in the timeline of what we're talking about, Brother Darkness, he visited the temple. He got to go there and see it, interact with it. And I want to see more about that religion, because there's a lot of good shows use those type of religions, like the religious zealots, in such a unique way that I want to see how they use this religion to further the plot, further the story.
Completely agree. I definitely am interested in that backstory as well. That kind of leads us in here. So we have talked about all three. We did give our predictions on episode four, or at least where we think the story is going to go. I did want to do just kind of an overview of kind of what I think thematically of the show, which I think is probably its strongest thing, that I think is the themes that it's exploring in the show, and how kind of elemental they are to science fiction. But we did go long. Does it say how long we've been going for on Twitch?
An hour and 32 minutes.
So about an hour and 32 minutes. Okay, that makes sense. We did go longer in this one because we're doing episodes one through three. We'll be streaming on Fridays. We're going to do episode four next week. And they're probably going to be a lot shorter than this, just because we wanted to get all three out on this one here. But real quick, too, thematically on the show, one of the strongest things I think about it is the theme of, like, this show is... Of anything I've seen visually, or like on a TV show or movie, this seems like the most emblematic of science fiction, in that it's fiction about science as a concept. So the whole theme of this is like, it's a story about the importance of science in general. So it's not talking about a specific scientific idea or a specific scientific property. It's talking about science as a whole. And that's what I think is really interesting about this show. The idea of the foundation and about building on the knowledge of your forefathers and taking it into the future is what science is as a concept. And the Imperial cloning also mirrors that theme, in that they're building on the dynasties of their past and then leading it into the future. And it's this kind of standing on the shoulders of giants and seeing how much farther you can go with it. That's kind of the concept of the show. It also is weaving in different things about science as well as faith, and saying that, you know, with numbers and math represent kind of a scientific point of view, but Gale and her religion and her intuition is representing kind of more of a faith side of it. So it's really tackling both of those subject matter really, really beautifully so far, I think. Maybe not as beautiful in the books. Like I said, we haven't read it. So
yeah.
I'm going strictly based on the show. But those ideas, I think, are really relevant today. They're very important. And like I said, it's so elemental to what science fiction is, which is usually science fiction is about a certain technology, a certain scientific idea. And this one feels like it's very wide scoped, and it's about science as a whole. Like, what's the idea of science and what's the importance of it in society? And what's the importance of building on knowledge and using knowledge and stuff. And it's kind of being a hero or a warrior for that idea and that concept, which I think is great. Did you get that in the show too? Those kind of feelings or concepts?
Yeah, no, I definitely did get it. And I also got, like, I think it's more like a philosophical theme, like definitely the science fiction stuff. And the philosophical theme that I got was like religion versus science, like religion versus actual like stuff that you could not predict, but you could tell, like the laws of science.
Right. Like faith versus science and stuff.
Yeah. So you got to see a lot of that battle, especially in like the first two episodes of faith versus science.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the themes that I really want to see him start tackling more and start exploring more of, like, we have to see where Gale comes in and
Yeah.
stuff like that, coming from a society where science was viewed as evil to a society where science is viewed as like the law, like it was
Right.
viewed how it is today, like the laws of science. Yeah, you nailed it right on it. So
Yeah.
more of like the philosophical debate of what is society, what is future, what is this, science versus religion. So having more of that is something I definitely want to see them tackle, and I think they're doing it in a very unique way, and I like how they're doing it.
Yeah, and I think that kind of puts a bow on it here. I think we're gonna do episode 4 Friday. Do you want to say around a similar time, like around 6:30, 6:30 Central or 7:30 your time?
Yeah, probably 7:30 our time, because like as funny as it is, next week I'm gonna be in New York, so
Okay.
it's gonna be because I'm gonna have to like wake up like at the crack ass of dawn, watch the episode, do New York
Right,
Comic Con,
right.
and then
Oh
record this
wow. Okay, so that's
afterwards.
gonna be a busy day for you. So yeah, we could do. I mean, if a day works better for you, you could always
Oh,
do that.
dude,
We'll just
no, we're doing it Friday. Like
okay. We'll
we're
do it
doing
Friday.
it
All right.
Friday.
So yeah,
Hands down, doing it
we'll
Friday.
say Friday. We'll say 7:30 Eastern, 6:30 Central. We'll go live and talk about the episode. I'm really excited about it. I think this was a lot of fun though.
It was.
This is definitely a show worth talking about, or worth kind of deep diving into. So I'm really excited to see how it goes. But I appreciate any of you guys for hanging out with us. For the past what hour and 45 minutes, it's been a
36
long
minutes
one.
right now.
Yeah. I appreciate anyone kind of tuning in and hanging out with us. If you
Yeah.
guys definitely want to watch us, I do have my social handles linked here if you want to follow. Is there anywhere that they can find you online, or do you have anything coming up that you'd like to promo?
Nothing coming up right now. I'm doing New York Comic Con next week, so
Oh, cool.
I'll probably write a couple of stuff like that, just post up on Geeks Worldwide. So as of right now, just that's going to be where you can find me at the Geeks Worldwide, so the GWW.com. That's about it for me.
Awesome. Yeah. So, I have my social handles linked below. We do a diss track watch party. So if you guys are into kind of like cheesy, fun movies, especially now in October, we're doing a lot of Halloween stuff. If you guys want to watch movies with us live, we do that every Monday. I'm sorry, at 8 p.m. Eastern time. So you can definitely check out on the channel there, and then just kind of sync up and watch a corny movie with us if you guys want to check it out. But again, thank you guys for hanging out. We're gonna go ahead and wrap it up, and we will see you guys Friday.